It's Ken Bergen here, and welcome to the Hospo Reset podcast. Each episode, I explore trends, innovation, and smart thinking in the hospitality industry with a particular focus on restaurants, cafes, and food service. You'll find the show notes and links for today's episode on your podcast app and look for the link at the top of the hosporeset.com website. Don't forget to subscribe to the weekly Hospo Reset newsletter and connect with me on LinkedIn and on Twitter. Hi, it's Ken Bergen here from the Hospo Reset podcast. Today I'm talking to Liz Perkins from the Hospitality Company, and we're talking about developing restaurant managers for the digital age. And there is a lot to discuss. I previously interviewed Liz for podcast number 13, which was on teaching chefs about kitchen management and menu design. And it's actually one of our most popular episodes. So I really recommend you have a listen into that one if you haven't already. Anyway, great to talk to you again, Liz. Really look forward to this discussion. Nice. Good one. So before we dive into, well, you look at what you call pillars of business, don't you? You got five pillars: finance, marketing, sales, fulfillment, systems, people, and then tying them together, leadership. And I'll ask you to unpack those a little bit and apply this kind of digital lens to it as well. But just tell us a bit about your background and I guess your own digital development as well.
Yeah, well, I have a bit of like a personal version of how I approached leadership and got better at leadership. So you'll remember from a little bit of my history, if you listened to the last time I was on your podcast, I've been in hospitality all of my adult life, and with an early background in chefing and then a lot of general management and then into ownership. And I think I was young and female. I'm working on one of those. The other one's probably going to stick around for a while, but working on the young part. But I think that I had a perception of what a good leader was or what a good manager was. And I think that I thought I needed to be firm and not flexible and strong and not let anything be multi-choice. I had a saying where I used to say to people, "This is not multi-choice," which is a terrible phrase to use on people. But and I think it wasn't probably until I was in my early 30s and really had some great people in my blind spots that I realized that actually that leadership style that I had adopted was quite contrary to my natural personality style. And so it was really, they were really, the two things were rubbing against each other, and it was stopping my development as a leader.
Interesting.
And I discovered this, and it's, I mean, it's been around forever. It's my own lack of research that took me so long to find it. But this concept of servant leadership, where you do everything you can for the people around you so that they can have success. And so it wasn't really till I realized that actually apologizing, being humble, showing my weaknesses, asking for help, getting on board with people's dreams and ambitions and finding ways that you can get your business to support those for people, that actually that became a lot more rewarding, and it fitted a lot more with my natural style. Because in hospitality, a lot of us are very generous, giving people. That's why we're attracted to hospitality. And so to try and lead with that hospitality heart, that actually became a more natural process for me. Certainly, I wouldn't use the word easy, but it was definitely more natural.
Yeah, you're reminding me of that traditional thing, though. You talk about the hospitality heart, but, you know, the kitchen, the traditional hierarchy thing. I remember a young chef coming to work for me, and he was going to be in charge of a section. And he was explaining to me, "Mr. Bergen, you got to understand, in the kitchen, there's no pleases and no thank yous." And it was really just like, that's how he'd been kind of brought up and what he'd absorbed since the age of 14 and a half or 15, whenever. And it was really, I'd heard it before, it really kind of took me back to see a young person kind of so definite about this. And it's really the opposite to what you're saying too, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Our version of that was the pleases and thank yous are implied.
Yeah, yeah.
Are they though? Yeah, so it's definitely not, it's certainly not a modern way to lead, and quite a destructive and I think limiting way to lead people.
Yeah. So we're going to look at developing manager skills across these five pillars. Let's just, why don't you just explain them, the five in a bit, a little bit of detail for us. Yeah.
So what often happens when I'm having conversations with owners and managers is that there's a lot of noise around them. And the first thing that they find very useful was to try and put things into categories or into boxes, into corners, so that they can get their head around it. And so the idea of the
noise, as in lots of confusion and lots of mess and lots
what
of,
am I supposed to be working on? There seems so many things I should be doing, and I don't know what to do, and what do I do first? And you know, I like the analogy, it's actually in one of Nike's business books, but that analogy of rubber balls and glass balls. And so that trying to identify which things in your business are rubber balls and you can afford to drop them because they'll bounce back.
Okay,
and what are glass balls and you can and you
don't
can't
you
afford
dare.
To drop those because you might not smash them, but they might get chipped or scuffed or there's always going to be a mark on them. So identifying your key priorities and making sure that you're putting 80% of your effort into those key priorities. So the first is finance. So we usually start with finance with people. Finance is usually something that is at the top of most people's pain points. It's the where everything condenses down to. All of the issues within your business and the dysfunction tend to seep out into the
why
finances.
I'm not sleeping.
Why you're not sleeping, And so we start with finance usually, and because it's such a firm, measurable opportunity to see performance improving. So finance is really very systems-based, and it should come become very task-orientated and very methodical. So it should be something that is incredibly important to your business, but is done in a very systemized, not time-consuming way. So we want a lot of leverage in that finance space. We want to leverage from software in there wherever possible. So it starts at the very beginning with a great point of sale, all the way up to a really good accounting piece of software and the bridges in between, things like Mr. Yum or Loaded Reports or any of the great softwares that have been built by hospitality-centric businesses. So you want to have a suite of software in there that's going to make life more simplistic for you. So the key thing around software is it needs to be, I think, flexible and teachable. So we don't want something that's so firm that you can't make it work for your business and your unique way of doing business. And we don't want something that's so complicated that we can't teach it to other people.
And I guess the thing now with finance is the numbers are instantly available.
Yeah, brilliant.
Just flick on your phone rather than waiting for end of the month or
absolutely.
Quarter.
So that's the basis around finance. It's a really big conversation and it takes a lot of really strategic work to get it tidy. But once it's tidy, it really should be something that's almost automatic. And then the next on the list that we've got there is marketing, sales and fulfillment. So we took the traditional sales and marketing and we call it marketing, sales and fulfillment, or MSF for short. So marketing is the invitation. That's the measuring of your market, who is in my market, know your market, who realistically is going to be my key customers, identifying them and finding great ways to communicate with them. That is marketing. And then once they're inside your building, that's the sales element. So the sales, when you think about sales, you want to think about the guest experience. So I think one of the most frightening words in hospitality to hospitality-centric people is the concept of selling. Like we just, if we were into it, we would be in retail, not hospitality.
Well, McDonald's chips.
That whole, when I was a teenager, I worked at KFC and that whole creamy chocolate mousse. Would you like any creamy chocolate mousse with that? I used to get in so much trouble for not saying it because I was just embarrassed. I was just so embarrassed at the idea. Obviously could tell the guest didn't want that. So why am I going to annoy them by saying it? And I think that's what gives me a good hospitality heart, that I can read people. That's what great hospitality people can do. We read cues from people when we design their experience around that. And so we don't want to call it selling. In the hospitality company, what we refer to those moments as is UTBs, or opportunities to buy. So we're giving our guests opportunities to buy. We're giving them opportunities to fulfill their dream experience by asking great questions. And I always explain to frontline staff when I'm training them and they're nervous about the concept of asking for another drink or asking people if they want a dessert, the fault isn't in them saying no. Them saying no is not the loss of value. You offering them something is sending them a very clear message that you want them to stay, that they're welcome. that you want to keep hosting them. And so even if they say no, there's no sale, but you are absolutely banking some love for another visit. And so it's not about today's dollar, it's about tomorrow's. That's a phrase I stole from Danny Meyer from Union Square. So you don't just have to get today's dollar, we're trying to guarantee tomorrow's. So the value of that guest is more exponentially over their lifetime than just in that one moment. So that's the sales part. And then fulfillment is the conversation that you have.
Yeah, I'm interested
people.
That you add this extra, the F to the marketing and sales.
So marketing and sales is very transactional. And if we stop the funnel there at sales, so you imagine that marketing and sales is a funnel. So we've got a really large catchment at the top for marketing and it's narrowing down to that sales point. That's a traditional looking sales funnel. If we look at that and invert it after the sales point so that we've got an upside down funnel underneath that. So you can imagine it looks a little bit like an hourglass. So we've got the marketing at the top with the exposing ourselves to the market and then the sales point or the guest experience. And when we give a great guest experience, we have the opportunity to turn somebody into a raving fan. And once we have them as a raving fan, so we've given them a wonderful experience, they really loved our venue. So we're not talking about satisfactory experience, we're talking about a transformational experience. So we've moved it from being transactional to being transformational by giving them a huge amount of hospitality, right? So they are now a raving fan. Now there's the opportunity to leverage that relationship when they've left the business if we can now communicate with them in a meaningful way. So if you imagine the bottom half of that hourglass, the bottom half of that funnel is a raving fan that we want to turn into a member of our community. So we want to build a community around our business. And this is the same for all businesses, but hospitality has definitely got a head start around that building of a community. And I'm speaking to my age group and older, but, you know, that Cheers mentality where you come to a venue and everybody knows your name. We should know things about our raving fans. And knowing things about them gives us the opportunity to give them much more meaningful experiences. People who are raving fans that we through great communication strategies, so I'm talking about loyalty programs, newsletters, strategic ads placed for them, community support programs where we are sponsoring events and activities in the community, where we're doing that sort of work, we're building our raving fans into a community around us. And community members are what we refer to as being third placer. So in your life, you have three places. Your first place is home, your second place is work, and you have a third place. We want to be people's third place. So I jokingly tell people that my third place is the gym. Obviously isn't, but I like to pretend it's the
gym. For some people it is.
People it is, just not me. But I aspire for it to be.
Okay.
So my third place is the cafe around
instead
the corner
of KFC. Where I get a coffee.
But it's really easy for us in hospitality to become people's third place. It's the essence of what a hospitality business is. And regardless of where you are, whether you're in the bottom of a big commercial building in a CBD in a city, or you're on the back road to a small between a couple of small towns, you have the opportunity to become somebody's third place. And once you are somebody's third place, the decision to come to you is subconscious. So when you are somebody's third place, you don't have to market to them anymore. You just have to suggest to them that's a good idea to come and see you, and they will. It's like they're in love with you. Any excuse to see you and they'll come. Okay. So that's marketing, sales, and that really strong strategy around fulfillment.
So now we've got five pillars. Before we go on to the others, let's talk about developing restaurant managers for these first two, finance, marketing, sales, fulfillment. So, I mean, we're developing a manager who may be in his 30s or she's in her 40s or something like that. Lots of experience, but always we all need to develop. Or it might be a youngie who's just kind of 20, 21 or something like that. But what are some of the elements for developing people across those two pillars you talked about?
Well, from a theory point of view, I'm a big fan of identifying people's strengths. And I'll get this quote worded wrong, but, you know, there's a great quote in a Gallup book that talks about don't bother trying to work on what somebody has left out, so their weaknesses, working on what they've got left in, their strengths, is enough, more than enough.
Nice. I like that.
So people should be aware of the weaknesses of their managers, and we want to try and plug the weaknesses, but we want to spend 20% of our energy plugging somebody's weaknesses and be really good at identifying their strengths and maximizing those strengths with 80% of our energy. So if you've got somebody on your team, so if we talk about the five pillars, let's park leadership for a moment. Imagine leadership is the one that holds them all together. Mm-hmm. Imagine those other four that are left, finance, marketing, sales, and fulfillment, people, which means internal people, and systems. Imagine those four pillars as legs of a dining room table. Mm-hmm. We want to make sure that those four legs are even so that the top of our table, our business, is even. Right. So we don't want to have strengths in one side and not the other. What you'll find with managers and anybody is they will have a talent for one side of the table and not the other. So if we think about finance and systems as being one side of the table, very methodical, very tidy, very trustworthy, repetitive, that suits a certain strength. The other side, marketing, sales and fulfillment and people or the team, that's another side. So that's a very good at communication.
So you're talking different personality types.
Yes, although I'm not a raving fan of personality typing. I think that's, I think that we bring out different different personality traits in different situations and we evolve through our lives through experience. Yeah. So I definitely think we've got talents, which I think of as being superhighways. And although we can do the others, they might be more like dirt roads. So if we've got no development going on in our lives.
I love all your analogies.
Well, I steal them from other people much smarter than me.
But they work.
Well, they're visual, right? I'm a visual learner.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you know what your talent is, then those things are going to come quite easy to you as a leader. And so you want to maximize those talents and you want to be able to leverage from some software help for the things that aren't your talent, or if you're in a big team, leverage from your 2ICs and find 2ICs that have your weaknesses as their talents. Don't expect to be an expert at all of those.
Yeah. And I like this, that obviously always was, we'll find a team member who's better at this and let's work together and cover our strengths. But you've added another element, which is really what today's about too, is there's software and there's digital solutions which actually can cover my ass a bit, really, if like I'm really kind of the numbers thing, just really, just not me, but I can see this little dashboard or this little graph about this week compared to last week and something, and it's just like it's visual. And I'm getting good at finance now, you know, or good enough for what my job is.
Well, I think like I spend a lot of time teaching finances. Finance is an area that I definitely have as a strength. It's something I find really natural and really easy, and I kind of, it's like a puzzle to me, and I can bring it together and create a picture. I really love it, but I recognize that's, that somebody will be listening to this and cringing at the idea of how can you find that exciting. So for those people that don't have finance as a talent, I think that there's a huge amount of help out there for that. Probably of all of the pillars, it's the one that's got the most software help because it's probably the one that entrepreneurial, creative, business creators find the hardest because it's opposite to that style of thinking.
Yes.
So there's a lot of help in that space. But it's really, again, about getting rid of some of the noise. So the key competencies or the key things you need to hold on to in finance is really making sure that you're concentrating on the numbers that you can make the biggest difference around.
So there's lots of noise within the world of noise. Just finance, lots of KPIs flying all over the place and crazy spreadsheets. And,
So you want to be thinking about it in terms of, so let me use this analogy for you. I, for whatever mad reason, am into doing Ironman. Mm-hmm. So Ironman is a long distance triathlon. It has 3.9 kilometers of swimming, 180 Ks of biking and a full marathon, 42.2 Ks.
Right.
The swim is about one tenth of the time of the whole event.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
The bike is almost half, and then the run is the remaining 40%. So if I were to try and improve my swim time by 10% as opposed and not improve my bike or my run, because I only have enough brain space and energy and time in my life to work on one discipline, it makes no sense at all to work on the swim. because I'm only going to gain 10% there. If I put that same effort into the bike or the run, I'm going to get a much better return on investment for my 10% improvement. So if you look at business in the same way, if you are looking at your accounts and four main numbers in any hospitality business's accounts, there's the top line, the sales at the top, and then there's our costs of goods, our wages, and our overheads. So the overheads are all of the other numbers, rent, insurance, power, packaging, cleaning, managed professional development, all of that, everything else that we give money to lives under overheads. There's very few things in the overheads category that a manager can influence with as much impact as they can influence the other three by. So we have to be very careful, and this is something that owners need to hear, we need to be very careful that we're separating the difference between governance and management. So what are governance decisions in our profit and loss statements, and what are management decisions? So everything below the overhead lines, just about exclusively, is a governance decision. So there's no point in judging the performance of our managers with those. Let's let them become absolute rock star experts at increasing sales, getting efficient wages, and controlling cost of goods. Those are the three areas that we want them to be obsessed about. Let the rest of it go. The only way they can improve sales is to increase spend per head or increase guest numbers. That's it. Those are the only two actions. And the only way they can improve costs of goods is by managing the costs more efficiently. Now, there's a list of 20 things underneath that you can do. And the only thing that they can do to influence the wages is improve efficiency or increase the sales. So get rid of the noise of the reporting and focus on the actions that create that report. So being really careful that you're focusing the manager's expertise on actions, not results, because the results come from the actions. We spend too much time looking in the rear vision mirror at the numbers and not in through the windscreen at the potential.
And not giving the managers or the head chef the tools that are timely and efficient, and also
the education,
and the servant leadership thing to me around, like, throwing recipe software at a chef and saying, here, I've got this new toy, you need to do it. They might type with two fingers.
Exactly.
Servant leadership is someone else who's going to take your recipe book and type it all up. Now, you can come through and make any corrections, but, you know, like, we actually need good admin support. Something I often kind of identify as, where's the person who's actually doing the grunt work, the number work, and sorting the invoices and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, the way I sort of think about it, particularly with chefs, but I think probably a lot of hospitality employees, is that we haven't had, if you think about the different learning styles, we are obviously kinesthetic learners. We learn best through doing. We find that the most rewarding way to fulfill our lives is by doing things with our hands. We like to be hands-on, right? So that's a talent. We've had that as a talent our whole lives. It's a lot of the reason we've been attracted to hospitality. And then we've spent our professional careers perfecting that learning style, and we've strengthened that pathway. So that's become the superhighway, right? If we then expect those people who have spent their entire lives becoming experts at making their brains work while they're moving, and ask them to sit in front of a computer and make their brains work in a way that they're not used to, it's essentially like asking them to run backwards. It's incredibly unnatural for them. So making sure, like, a servant leader would look to help them win in that space. So the win might look like 1 hour a day, not a whole office day. Or it might look like, I'm going to sit beside you and coach you through this for as long as it takes until you are comfortable with this. Yeah. So we might look at the opportunity to put somebody in there to help you, or we might look at the opportunity to, this is never going to become a highway for you, but let's at least make it a road.
Let's seal that road.
Yeah. Let's get a sealed road for you and give you some confidence around it.
Yeah.
But let's make sure that we are doing that in a way where we're walking beside you, not dragging you along behind us.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that the thing that we have to be really aware of is that term of that continuous improvement, is that don't ever think that you're finished. You're never finished when it comes to technology solutions. There's always something more coming. So keeping your minds open to that, and making sure that you are leaving yourself open to the idea that there's a new product out there. You don't have to be the leaders. Being number two is a great solution when it comes
to
software.
When we think of something like scanning invoices and reading them, that's perfect. 2 or 3 years old now, but I mean, that is a kind of like a more recent thing that still a lot of people don't use. It's like, really? Wow.
Oh, yeah. It freaks me out when I see places that have paper timesheets and Excel rosters. It's like, you're making your life harder just because you don't want to take that moment to learn. And so I think that's something that all managers should be allowed is some professional development time. So making sure that we are releasing them from work for at least an hour a week to listen to a podcast, read a book, do a course, something where we're giving them that.
And hold them a little bit accountable to, in a nice way, discussion about
what did you learn?
What have you been learning this week?
How can we apply it? So I'm a raving fan, obviously, of educating hospitality people. When I had my team, it was just a matter of saying to them, everything I offer you in terms of learning, I just want one thing out of it. I just want you to come back to me with one thing, even if it is, I think we do this better than they're suggesting. I think actually our way is more developed and better. But just letting them have that coaching moment with them. I truly believe that if you haven't taught your managers what great looks like, they don't know. So
I remember a coach once saying that in the fine dining situation, we expect our staff to be sophisticated and worldly and knowledgeable, all this. And he said, it's very difficult for someone to offer service at a level beyond that which they themselves have experienced. And most of our youngies, they never sit down at a white tablecloth restaurant. They don't have the money for that. We don't pay them enough to do that, or it's just not part of their cultural firmament.
My first few restaurants I worked in were fine dining when I was still a teenager. And I had, my grandparents are in their 90s, and they were very formal when we had dinner with them. So the idea of the cutlery laid out the way it should be and the glassware sitting where it should be, I think if I hadn't had that experience, I probably would have failed in fine dining.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't have known those little tips and, how it's supposed to be. So,
Now we talked before about not wanting to kind of make people sell. And now sort of, I think it's a Kiwi and Aussie kind of reaction to sales. If you were in the US, it might have a different response to this. But we still need our staff to use some scripts and upsell. And if two people are ordering pasta, we really want a salad suggested, etc. So how do we develop that kind of selling skills in management and the selling coach, the coaching of selling, which is the manager's responsibility?
So I think it needs a bit of a flip on its head, that conversation around how we do that. So there's two parts to this. The first is there is evolving technology at the moment that's really aiding that around that table ordering, the QR codes, scan the QR codes. And that is definitely an asset. So one of the things that I think I'm a good front of house seller. Like I've got my head around the fact of how I do it. And I'm certainly, I have a lot of faults, Ken, but laziness is not one of them. So you wouldn't have caught me avoiding a table for any reason. But there's still times in a busy service where I knew I could have got that person another drink, but I just couldn't get there. And so there is software out there now to help those guests order a drink when they want the drink, and for us to not have to preempt every move that they might make. So I definitely think that making sure that you are on board with that type of software. I'm a raving fan of Mist because I like their company culture, but something like that where you are using that table order service to help and mixing that with a traditional hospitality offering. So the idea around hospitality people selling, you're right, it's a very New Zealand, Australian, greats against our, we like to give people a good deal, we don't want to be pushy, we really cringe against it when it's done to us, is recognising that people buy from people they like. So your job isn't to sell things to your guests, your job is to get the guests to like you. And you get the guests to like you by spending time with them.
You're reminding me with the online ordering I saw on one of the forums during the week, someone had done a screenshot of an order for two people, and the one was like a risotto and one was a pasta or something. And these people had ordered every imaginable side with that.
Wicked.
And this guy said, "This is so crazy. There is no way in the world we could have ever sold that to them the old way." But they chose it. They wanted it all. And it was almost like double, you know, the sale value. Yeah.
I certainly and think that so, as a female.
Yeah, who are we to stand in the way of
absolutely.
People want to do
absolutely.
That?
And I just think I am guilty of sitting in front of my laptop in the evening and filling up my shopping cart with online shopping. So we're all quite used to it. But I do think particularly in this, I'm making a generalization here, which I know we're not supposed to do anymore. But as a female, I would sometimes struggle to order all of those sides in front of somebody for the fear of looking greedy. Yeah, there's nothing that I cringe more at, Ken, than going to a wedding where there's a buffet. I'm like, I'm going to starve. Because I am not walking across the room with a plate full of food, and I'm not going back for seconds. So unless I can con my husband into getting a second plate or switching plates with me as we cross the room, there's nothing like I just – the idea of people seeing what I'm going to eat, I can't stand it. So you can see how that lines up with the correlation.
The QR, the digital ordering allows a kind of privacy.
Yeah, it does. I think it really does. And
in a
you know,
good
we were
way,
talked
yeah.
before we started recording this, and both of us were early to this call, and that the idea of being time sensitive. I went to a restaurant probably a month ago now, and they had the ordering app, local restaurant that has the movie theater beside it, and we were due in the movie theater for the movies, and we arrived, and there was a group of a few couples. And we sat down and one of the couples wasn't there on time. And for me, that's a massive anxiety, that idea of being late. So the fact that I could order on that app and not have to wait for the waitress who was flat out because she was serving everybody who was going to the movies at the same time, it just meant that I could get that done and relax. And I think everybody in hospitality is listening to this knows that once a guest has ordered, there's a physical relaxing for that guest. They're calmer once they put their order in. So to give that power to them, I think really sets us up for a great guest experience.
And then enables our supervisor or waiter or
to
whatever to
host.
Actually, be a host and just have a little bit, make a little bit of fuss or... Yeah, ask a question or something like
that. I call those moments love in the bank. So the more love we can put in the bank,
love
the more
the
a withdrawal won't be noticed. That's what I think.
Let's talk about two more pillars, systems and people. What's a kind of
– so?
How do we add a digital element to restaurant management?
Yeah, so we want to start there with people. So people is about your team and about empowering your team. So it's about making sure that you've actually got a people strategy. So there's 5 points in that people strategy to consider is the attraction. So are you attracting the right people? Do you even know what the right person looks like? So profile our guests. What type of guests are we trying to attract to our businesses? Whether we do that really loosely or very scientifically, most people have decided who they want to be to the market. But have you done the same thing with your attraction campaign? Do you know what type of people you want to hire? And have you clearly documented and articulated that? And let your attraction strategy reflect that. So are we attracting the right people? Are we recruiting them in a really efficient way? Interviewing is a very time-consuming, emotionally draining experience. Let's not do too much of it.
You used the word efficient there, and boy, is there some inefficient recruitment.
Yeah. And there is there are really good software answers to that. There's some great HR programs out there that funnel people into that from the recruitment point. And it's automated, you know, them tapping in to get an interview and tapping in to fill in an application form and then having documents sent out to them. You shouldn't be standing beside your printer printing out a contract 5 minutes before they come in to pick it up. All of that should be able to be automated digitally for you. So looking into programs that do that for you. A lot of payroll systems have that as an add-on. So whatever payroll system you're using, I would start with that. I would start by going to them and saying, do you have an HR component? And if they don't, going looking for another one that does. Okay. Because it's good for them to be tied in together, those two programs. So you've got attraction, recruitment, induction. So that induction process should be automated as much as possible in my business. So separating out induction and training, they're two different things. Induction is about culture. It's about getting people to get on board with your culture and your values and who you guys are as a team. Training is about handing over skills and knowledge. So training is how to do the job. Induction is about who we are.
What are your thoughts about in the recruitment stage about some testing around, well, you said you're not a fan of personality types, but something related to that. Do you see any value sorting people?
I do, and I use this tool that was created in New Zealand called DOTS, the DOTS communication tool, right? So it's like Myers-Briggs and DISC and those sort of personality testing, but in a much more short, sharp and usable way. But I think what we do as humans, because we're always trying to find the shortest possible route, is we lean too much on those and we do them too externally with other people and not reflective enough on ourselves. So I actually think when it comes to recruitment, you need to be doing a lot of work around who you are and that what we talked about before about those strengths and weaknesses. Don't hire people like you necessarily, hire people that are going to be assets to you or complement you. So making sure that you're being really honest with yourself about what your strengths and weaknesses are and finding people that will complement those in a humble and in a harmonious way, knowing who you are, what your values are. It's, you can't live somebody else's core values. You can only live your own. So identifying your core values is a great place to start with that recruitment process. What is it that you value? Don't be really honest about that. So don't put down the answers of core values that you think people want to hear. Put down the answers to the core values that are true. So for example, I wrote when I did the core values exercise years ago, I circled family as a core value. In actual fact, one of my other core values was competitiveness, which sounds ugly to some people. But when I actually found myself at a junction of choosing to be at a family event or going to the restaurant because they needed me, I chose the restaurant. So my version of family was that I saw myself as being responsible for the income. And so that meant that the business had to be healthy, which meant it came first. So although I would like to have had family as a core value and I'd like to have that feel good sensation of saying I put my family first, the reality is I didn't. I put my business first. And I'm not talking about an extreme emergency situation. I'm talking about a day-to-day basis, right? So don't try and answer the core values exercise on values that you at a crossroad in your life you wouldn't actually live. They've got to be your genuine core values because they are far easier to live than trying to live up to a core value that isn't yours. Now, you can't change people's core values. They're formed in childhood through the way they're brought up and their life experiences. And so you can't change somebody that comes into a recruitment process. You can't change their core values. All you can do is hope to line up with some of yours. And that way you're going to find your relationship more harmonious. You're probably not going to have the same, all of your core values the same. So it pays to rate them, which ones are the most valuable. For me, kindness was the most valuable. So if I had somebody who was competitive, because I like people who are competitive because I feel like they strive for excellence, they're numbers orientated, they love a good game, they're into winning, right? But I wouldn't take somebody with that core value over somebody who was kind. Because to me, the one thing I didn't like working around was a lack of kindness. When my team was dysfunctional, it's because there wasn't enough kindness. So choose the values that match the that you find.
And interesting you said that there's a point at one stage where it was like, do I choose business or family? It was, I think that was the choice. And maybe there's a bit of an Anglo kind of thing there where we see one versus the other, whereas it reminded me of a Vietnamese friend of mine whose family have always been in restaurants. And he said, Ken, you got to understand, in a Vietnamese family, the family is the business. We all work hard and it's just like it's head down and that's...
Be together,
It's different. So, and I think, well, anyone who's in hospo, those kind of like those phone calls when you got to cover something or whatever, it's just like, it's all mixed up.
Yeah, and certainly, I mean, mine was a family-owned business. There was two two parts of my family owned it together. And all four of my adult children had worked there. So, and one of my sisters. And so it was, we definitely had that family element in there. But I it was the identifying that my role in the family was as the head of this family business. And so that meant that was my contribution to the family.
Making sure the business was strong.
So making sure that you're identifying what it is you want in somebody before you begin that recruitment process. It helps you to identify them much, much quicker.
Yeah. So systems, which is kind of the core of all the things we've been talking about so far, but you've got that as a separate pillar.
So think of systems when you're going through those three pillars that we've talked about already. Think of systems as being the solution to some of the problems you're identifying in those other areas. So I always think about systems as being, when I'm working, brainstorming with people where they're up to with those other pillars, systems is where we drop in some of those answers. So if we're hanging out in the finance pillar and we're talking about cost of goods management and we've identified that's not very systemized and not very slick, to me, in my world, loaded reports becomes the solution to that. So loaded reports becomes the software that's going to help leverage that finance up higher. Yeah. If we're looking at marketing, sales, and fulfillment, it would be, okay, what is my loyalty program? What is my CRM? What are my guest experience moments like? And how can I systemize those? So when you're looking at systems, the thing that you're aiming for, and it's always this unattainable goal, but you're trying to move towards it all the time, which some people will hate the idea of never actually getting there, is what they talk about in the book, The E-Myth, where they talk about the absolutely integrated operating system. So the way I like to think about that, the analogy I like to use with that, Ken, is to think about them as being threads that flow through the business. So what are the threads or the themes of your business that flow through, and where can those systems help leverage from that? I am from a Scottish background, and so I am very tight with money. And so one of the goals that I always had around any systems that we introduce into our business is that I would force myself to use 100% of their capability rather than finding another system. So once we entered into that software space and we worked really hard to get some great software solutions, one of the things that came out very quickly is that not every piece of software was the best at everything. So what I chose and what I would recommend for people is integration should trump perfection. So for example, an example of this is Loaded Reports. Loaded Reports, I think, is a fantastic stock management system. Just awesome. Flexible, teachable, repeatable, gives you great results, really easy to use, awesome. Their rostering system is good. It's not great. There are other rostering systems that are better, but because it integrates into one place where it's talking to the turnover and comparing against the current turnover and the budgets and the cost of goods and those three levers that I was talking about before, turnover, cost of goods and wages, living together in one place, that trumped having a separate software system that managed rosters. So the fact that all three of those elements of my P&L could live together in one piece of software was where the real value was. And I didn't want a situation where I was trying to develop managers and the first thing I had to do to bring on a new manager was give them 15 logins. I want them to be obsessed with one or two things. These things need to support their role, not dominate their role.
So the new manager who comes along and we're saying now we're really big on systems here and I'm going to walk you through them all. Are you finding that kind of that is generally, because we talked a bit about the different types of people as well, most people are kind of happy to kind of dive in and or is there still, I think, have this kind of cliche about creative types who kind of rebel against that sort of thing a bit. How do you handle
that? I think that it's making sure that that tool I talked about before, DOTS, I think that's a great tool to identify how somebody communicates. So the DOTS. So just to give you a real brief outline of that, it identifies four different communication styles. And we all communicate on all four, but some of them are more dominant than others. So the basic premise of it is, and it follows a really similar premise to perhaps DISC, if you've heard of DISC before, the red dot people are very rules-based people, speak in bullet points, not very social. Don't tend to get a lot of those in restaurants. You get some chefs that have got some element of that, but it doesn't. They're not people. They don't get energy from other people. Then there's the purple dots who think out loud. I'm one of those. So They're usually quite creative. They have a lot of ideas. They're very bubbly, very social, but they don't tend to finish things. They get 80% there and then they're bored, right?
Yeah.
So I like them to like a magpie. They're after the next shiny thing all the time. The yellow dot people are very organized, very timely. They like to be early to things. They like lists. They like things to be physically well presented, like my bookshelf you can see behind me. Very yellow dot way to arrange a bookshelf in its colors. So right, my two dominant communication styles are purple and then yellow. And then the fourth one is a blue dot. And a blue dot person is very sensitive, high empathy. They really process everything that they hear and everything they think about in terms of their feelings, right? So they're very feelings orientated. And the blue dot's really important to understand their communication style, because there's a lot of them in hospitality, because they're very good team players. So the
And how are they around systems?
They're good, but for different reasons than the others. So a red dot, excellent at systems, all over it, loves it, loves a good organizational chart, great admin. Think accountants and lawyers. Yeah, great.
Yeah.
They're very rules-based people. The purple dot people are really creative, and they often make it quite high up a management ladder because they're really engaging and they're high energy. And so but they tend to be a little bit disorganized. And so those are the ones that may need discipline around fulfilling some of those systems.
And systems can be a relief and a kind of scaffolding for them. Really,
sometimes, if they're aware of that as a strength and weakness for themselves, but they're often the ones that might flip between one system. Oh, I found a better one. I found a better one. I found a better one. Yeah.
Oh,
so
okay.
They sometimes have to be sensitive to what it's like for the people on their team to be led by a manager. So if a purple dot person is listening to this conversation, and a few moments ago we talked about that continuous improvement, I bet you they wrote that down or thought, yeah, that's me. I'm always improving things. But they have to understand that's actually quite uncomfortable for 75% of the rest of the population, right? So they just need to be aware of it and slow down a bit. Mm-hmm. The yellow dot people are great at systems, but for very self-centered reasons. They turn everything into a picture in their mind, and they've got an ideal of how something goes. Once they've got a picture in their mind, they're not very flexible. So it's really important that we make sure we paint a really great picture for them with a lot of detail, or they'll fill the detail in themselves and that will be where they stay. The blue dot people will complete tasks because of what it offers to the other people around them. They're team players. So they'll finish the tasks for other people. Now, the important thing about this particular tool, it's a tool, it's not a science. That's the thing that I think goes wrong with personality testing, is people think it's a science. It's not. I don't know if you know the story about how Myers-Briggs was created, do you? Myers-Briggs was a mother and a daughter, and one of the mother's son-in-laws came into the family and didn't gel with the family. And so she and her daughter came up with this personality test to figure out why some of the additions to their family fitted and some didn't. Neither of them had a background in psychology. Neither of them a background in leadership or communication. And it took off and became this world-class personality test.
Phenomenon.
So I think you've got to, all of those things, it's not that I'm against them, it's that I think we need to keep them in their place. They're tools, and they shouldn't be the entirety of how we think about somebody. So the thing around the dots is that everybody's got a dominant style, but everybody can talk with all of them. So the idea of that highways and dirt roads, I'm purple, yellow. So mostly when I'm comfortable, I live in that purple zone. If I am under pressure, I will move to that yellow. So when I'm cooking, I'm under pressure, I move to be very yellow. So my workspace and my mise en place, very organized, looks the same every day, meticulous, can't work in a dirty space, find it very stressful, tongs in the same place every day, sauces in the same order every day, looks visually very good. That's not a purple trait. That's my yellow trait coming out, because the purple trait wouldn't serve me in that environment. So I think if managers have some of these tools, they can start to understand how they can bring the best out in their people in different situations.
So this is leading us now into the last pillar, isn't it, around leadership? Yeah.
So the one of the things that I've only just read about in the last 12 months, but I thought was, I always think, Ken, if I read something that makes me uncomfortable, it's probably because it's right. It's challenged my thinking.
Yeah, okay.
So I try to read it a lot.
Tell us, what is it?
There's this really great piece of work that came out of an organization called Gallup Research, which you might have heard of, or people might have heard of from the States. Yep. And they wrote a really great book called First Break All the Rules. And the premise of it is that the talent of leadership and the talent of management are very different things. A manager is very compliant, and a leader is very is what's the word that they use? They're very disruptive. So you want to make sure that they're both really valuable. Organizations need both of them. Neither one is better or worse than the other. We need them both. But identifying that often in hospitality, we will promote people into leadership or management positions based on their skill as a technician. So if you are a great server or an excellent barista or a fast chef or whatever it is, we'll promote you because you're...
So they're compliant.
They're just really talented in what they do. That doesn't mean they've got a passion for leadership. So there is need in businesses for both. So supervisor level people, duty managers, I don't know what you call them in Australia, that supervisor alcohol... level or sous chefs or people that run the pass, they need to be that management compliant, ticking the boxes, making sure that everything is consistent, that we're sticking to the same standard, that we're maintaining the status quo, right? That's the strength of a manager. The strength of a leader is to push people to achieve more, to be greater.
Right. This
is disruptive. They are the ones that are looking to bring out the best in people. Disruptive has probably got negative connotations to it, but in this example, it's that they are weak and better. They're like a cheerleader. Yeah. Well, they're not necessarily pushy. They can sometimes be quite quiet. So one of the best examples I like in this situation is Apple, right? Apple computers. Apple computers leader, true leader, is Tim Cook. Not Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs was very creative, wonderful entrepreneur, really great genius of a thinker, but not a leader. The level 5 leader or the servant leader in that organization is Tim Cook. And the reason that Apple has gone from...
He got all the supply chain organized and all the manufacturing.
He's the one that developed the people. He's the one that had the passion for watching people become better. Now, I know he's famous because he's the CEO of Apple, but certainly for a long time there, he wasn't the rock star. Like, people didn't know his name. He wasn't at the forefront of conversations. But he is the reason that Apple is still going from strength to strength after Steve Jobs. If Steve Jobs were the reason and the sole reason behind the success of Apple, it would have crumbled by now. So I think understanding that we need managers, we need people who are compliant, who want to maintain standards, who want everything to be exactly the same all the time, to have that consistency, yeah?
So do we train our new manager or our developing manager in this subject, starting with L-call leadership, or is it actually something that comes out of building strengths across a whole lot of other things?
I think leadership is a born talent. I think it's definitely something that needs worked on. You definitely need to work on leadership. But if you don't get a real buzz out of watching somebody on your team grow and develop and succeed, and you're happy to take a back seat to their praise and let, you know, that there's a saying that a servant leader looks in the mirror when something goes wrong and looks out the window when their team is winning. So they push the praise out to their team when they're doing well and reflect on their own weaknesses when it's gone wrong. So a leader is somebody who isn't leading from the front. They're leading beside their people. So they're not looking to be the hero with 1,000 helpers. They're not looking to be the best or the rock star or a superior technician. They're looking to get, you can't teach it. They get a real thrill out of watching somebody else become better. One of the most valuable moments in my leadership journey have been when other people have exceeded their own expectations of themselves. When they've said, I don't understand finance and I'm never going to understand a profit and loss. And within 12 months, they're not just understanding the profit and loss, but they're manipulating and influencing it and changing it and growing it and teaching other people about it. And so to me, those are the rewarding moments of my leadership journey, not the financial rewards that I got or being in magazines or being in newspapers. None of that is a thrill in comparison to those moments. And so if you don't get a thrill out of other people's success and you don't have that, talked about that hospitality heart or that real teaching heart, that you love to see people succeed, then you're designed to be a manager and not a leader. And that's okay. We need you. We need you in our industries. We need consistency. We need compliance. We need people, technicians, to aspire to. We need people in our business who are fantastic baristas and fantastic chefs and show us what great hospitality looks like at the front of house. We need you to be aspirational for our people, but you're not a leader. A leader is somebody who actually, they're in black and white, not multicolour. They're sitting in the background, not necessarily out the front.
Yeah. Wow, you're giving me so much to think about, Liz. Just like the last time, I found it such a stimulating conversation last time, and this has been awesome as well. And yeah, I'm sure there'll be a great response to this discussion as well.
Yeah, there's quite a lot in so there. We often bring in more than we'd intended to. Sorry about that.
No, nothing to apologize about. So where do people find you if they want to make contact?
Yeah, so they can feel free to email me. My email's liz@thehospitalitycompany.co. So I don't know if you can put that, Ken, down in the notes or something. So just make sure that they do the .co at the end, no NZ. Or they can go to our website, thehospitalitycompany.co, and in there you can actually book a 15-minute call with me, Zoom call with me for free. If you've got anything in there that really excites you or you want me to point you in the direction of some more understanding around some of those points, then more than happy to do that. Yeah.
Terrific. Great. Loved our conversation. Thanks, Liz.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ken. It was great.
Thanks for joining me. I hope you're feeling inspired after listening to this episode. You'll find the show notes and links for today's episode on your podcast app and look for the link at the top of the hosporeset.com website. Don't forget to subscribe to the weekly Hospo Reset newsletter and connect with Ken Bergen on LinkedIn and on Twitter.